everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. It's your boy, Josh.
I'm Ian.
And I'm Daniel.
And we're back with another haunting episode. It's been a little while. I feel like it's been a month or so
since we've
covered a haunting. Been a lot of crazy true crime cases on the docket lately. But today we've got an especially terrifying episode for you on the Shea family haunting down there in Arkansas in a very, very historical home with a very dark history.
And you know what I appreciated about this story in general is I feel like a lot of times with these hauntings, you know, we're talking about the big cases. We're talking about Alcatraz. We're talking about, you know, something extremely well known. But we forget that the most affecting ones are often, you know, just for the small family. You know, they're the ones being terrorized.
And terrorized they were.
Big time.
By what many believe to be a demon of some sort.
Proper demon.
A proper demon named Seth.
Which that's up there with some of the scariest. You know, I feel like when they're just like regular guy names, that gets me more. Because I'm like, that I could imagine a scary Seth.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about the name Seth because this is an old, old biblical name back to the Cain and Abel days.
Mm-hmm.
This is a terrifying haunting that truly drove this family to the point of we need to get the fuck out of here.
Right.
Because our lives are so impacted, and our sleep especially, extremely impacted. And the kids, of course, because it seems like in many of these family hauntings, whatever these entities are, they are feeding off of the children, their emotions, their fear, and you know, they're the ones who are getting the brunt of
right
of all of the paranormal activity, it seems. But a terrifying true story at that. Jamie, the mom, who's done a lot of interviews, and I believe she has a podcast as well, where she's talked about her story and talks about other paranormal stories. But she's somebody who I feel like is very authentic, very genuine, and this genuinely happened to her and her family. And because, of course, you know, there's always skeptics, there's always people who
right.
are like, I don't know about that. But this is one of those I'm like, I don't know. There's not as many holes to poke
right.
in it, you know, unless you want to just completely discount a whole family sort of experience.
Right. If you want to come at it from just saying like, ghosts aren't real, get the fuck out of here, then sure, man. But I don't really want to hear what you have to say because even though I fall more on the skeptical side, what I appreciated about her was her candor. And I appreciated how, like in her separate interviews, she kind of talked about how people have manipulated her story and like overblown it at points, even though, you know, how do you overblow a
already terrifying story?
An insane haunting.
Yeah. And I think that speaks a lot to her credibility. So it's terrifying. And I mean, when you also understand the location and this colonial home that they moved into and you understand the background behind it, I think it becomes much more realistic to really fully believe like they had some sort of experience here that
right.
was terrifying and unexplained. And of course, a Ouija board gets brought in. Paranormal team brings in a Ouija board and things really go to hell after that.
You fucking assholes. Why'd you?
I know. I'm like, out of all the ways to contact, you know, they brought the Ouija board in and, you know, nothing ever good comes from a Ouija board session. But I did want to say Daniel's back after being gone last week and we're very happy to have him back. The poor guy, man. You might have already seen it on camera there, but Daniel really, really fucked up his hand. There's no way to put it.
I want to make it clear. I didn't do this on 4th of July. I didn't mess around with fireworks. I know the timing's there. This actually happened last Sunday. I had a kitchen accident and I severed the extensor tendon on my ring finger. So I had surgery last week. That's why I was out, but I'm back.
Better than ever too.
I will be.
Uh-huh.
What's the recovery look like? Did they say how long it might take?
The recovery is anywhere between like 3 to 6 months. Once it's all healed, I have to go through the therapy and everything to strengthen it back, but no lifting or anything that I like to do until that period. So
I was going to say, this is really tough for somebody who edits for a living, but also somebody who's as active as Daniel is. I mean, he's in the gym like 5 days a week at least.
And yeah.
Using your hands.
And yeah.
So you're out. Right.
I'm out for now. Once they clear me to at least start running again, you'll see me on the road. But
yeah,
until then, I'm not.
No fighting.
Anything. No, nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that'll be good for you to, you know, you can focus on other things.
Yeah.
The mental health.
Catch up on some reading. You know?
Some reading. Yeah.
Poetry.
There you go.
Yeah, poetry. Poetry. I can't write, but.
That's what we were talking about. You're going to do it with your left hand. You're going to figure it out.
I will be ambidextrous by the end of this.
Yes.
But yeah, send Daniel some love and support. Thank him for showing up because, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, dude, take all the time you need because it sounded immensely painful and I know it's still probably painful.
It was, but I was in shock when it happened, so I didn't really feel it.
Yeah. But even the days after surgery,
it's
like
sore. It's sore.
Super sore.
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and get into this Shea family haunting because, prepare to have chills run up and down your spine throughout this one because I certainly did. This is an absolutely insane paranormal story. So let's begin. The Shea family was ready for a change and eager to finally settle down and buy a home of their own. And during their search, they came across a beautiful white colonial house that seemed almost too perfect to pass up. What they didn't know, however, is that behind this charming facade, depravity was waiting within. Unseen forces plagued the home, manifesting as anything from faint whispers to the malevolence of total possession. Months of endless supernatural torment came to a head when the demonic entity usurped the mind of their 5-year-old son, immediately after their daughter was in a tragic car accident that confined her to a wheelchair after just barely escaping with her life. The unrelenting evil forces in the house put immense pressure on the growing family, eventually forcing them to abandon the property altogether. So our story takes place in Arkansas. The Ozark Mountains and the labyrinth forests of Arkansas are steeped in mystery and the inspiration for numerous terrifying legends. Dark energy lingers over places like Civil War battlefields, the infamous Crescent Hotel, and the arcane mounds at Plum Bayou. And for generations, locals have told stories of murderous swamp monsters and orbs hovering overhead, watching your every move. Every year, haunted houses and uncanny attractions draw in crowds looking for a safe scare. For the Shea family, however, fear wasn't something you could just buy and walk away from. In their home, the terror was constant, creeping in with the night and never allowing them even a second of relief. In Lamar, Arkansas, a white colonial house has been set among cotton fields and crumbling barns for hundreds of years. A host of Confederate soldiers lie underground in the cemetery, only a couple of hundred yards from the back door, and remote fields sprawl for miles around it. The air surrounding the old house is heavy with the memories of the enslaved people who suffered and toiled the land. The two-story home dating back to the 1800s sits alone on a small remote hill and is one of the oldest buildings in all of Arkansas. The property's beauty instantly mesmerized Jamie and Ben Shea, a happy young couple in the peak of their lives. As ardent history fans, they were stunned by the home's charming character. Jamie admired the archaic oak, walnut, pecan trees stretching their branches around the house, seeming to either shelter it or warn outsiders to stay away. The wide front porch, numerous vintage fireplaces and double chimneys made it cozy and welcoming. A cow-patterned mailbox added a certain whimsical touch, making it stand out even among the competition. And Jamie was absolutely captivated because of her lifelong fascination with the past. She knew without a doubt that she needed to get this house because it was everything she had ever dreamed of. The land also evoked Ben's childhood memories where he would play in the woods behind his home. He felt passionate about their kids playing outside and having the same kind of adventures. And as they toured the home, taking in the atmosphere and the smell of the dusty old wood, they walked into a disturbing scene upstairs. One of the bedrooms had been turned into a cultic ritual space. Painted pentagrams and other occult symbols covered the walls, and boarded up fireplace and burnt candles had been scattered across the floor. Ben always, the realist, suggested that, you know, some bored, troubled teenagers probably just broke in and were messing around. And despite this, they were so enamored with the home that this unsettling discovery did not dissuade them from eventually buying it. And the home was big enough to raise their kids, and on top of that, it was also affordable. It was supposedly listed at a considerably lower price than some of the similar homes in the area, making it a steal in all respects, but it just seemed too good to be true. And within only a couple of weeks, they realized it was.
You know, I have to say, if I saw this house while touring for my like first family home with everyone, immediate buy. I don't care about the pentagrams. I don't care about, I totally understand why they're like, whatever. Yeah, we'll just, we'll sweep up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your thought is just teenagers.
Just teenagers, an old ass house. People probably just come here all the time. That's why it's listed so low, right?
Yeah. And I think unless you're like a paranormal enthusiast,
right,
your first thought is not going to be, this house has got to be haunted. Do I want to live in a haunted house? But even if you are a paranormal enthusiast, maybe you're like, I'll be fine.
I'll be fine.
You know, like, what's the worst that could happen?
Right.
You know, some random knocks on the walls.
I can live with that.
A shadowy figure once in a while. Well, they were like, it's a big house. It's beautiful. It's got that, you know, historical charm to it. And they just don't build houses like this anymore.
They really don't.
So if you can get a steal on it, I think most of us probably
absolutely
swoop that up.
Absolutely. So on October 14th, 2002, Jamie and Ben moved in with their three kids, Tori, who was 10 years old, Bridger 5, and Jackson just 8 months old. Jamie worked as a legal assistant while Ben balanced life as a graveyard shift nurse and a college theater student. They were truly a power couple, juggling the kids while never giving up on their careers and education, and occasionally making time for themselves. Everything was looking incredibly promising as the family settled in to their new life. Before they finished unpacking, Jamie hosted a small yard sale to declutter. While watching people sift through old stuff and check price tags, she noticed an older woman acting strangely. She began wandering around the large porch, consumed by every little detail of the house. She didn't even seem to notice what was on sale, but was instead hypnotized by the towering walls in front of her. The woman turned to Jamie and candidly said, there are a lot of spirits in this house. I'm good.
Yeah, Ian, if you have a yard sale and somebody comes up and says, there's a lot of spirits in there.
I'm like, how do you, have you been inside my home?
Well, she's clearly got some psychic ability and she's just sensing the right presences there.
I don't know. If a strange old woman is telling me there are spirits inside my home, I'm listening.
I can't wait to bring a medium into the new studio and have them tell you there's spirits, there's a presence in there. Because there will be 1,000%.
Oh, for sure. For sure. We don't know what this land is on top of.
No. And also just, I think the show carries its own spirits.
We bring something with us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited to experience it.
Good. Get ready.
I think we should start the first episode with a Ouija board.
Yeah. Maybe Whoa. We do. Maybe we christen it with a Ouija board. That's a good idea.
Open it up. But this experience with Jamie, it made the hair stand on the back of her neck as she scrambled for something to say. She knew the place was old, but didn't think it was haunted by any means. The woman paused for a moment before adding, I can just feel it. Jamie tried to move on after the woman left, telling herself it was a freak encounter, but she simply couldn't. The woman seemed to wake all of her senses, making her second guess the land she occupied. After the yard sale, she looked around in the back of the house at the Confederate cemetery, where there were several headstones. They were practically unreadable, having endured centuries of decay and weathering. The edge of it was just a couple of hundred yards away from the back door, and you could almost feel it inching closer. Curiosity gripped Jamie, and she grabbed some etching paper and charcoal to trace over the weathered headstones, revealing faded names and dates. The deep, tangled history of the land fascinated her, but she wondered if she should take the woman's words more seriously. After all, it's hard to ignore when a stranger clearly says that you're surrounded, maybe even cornered, by spirits. I do love that headstone. They kept showing this one in particular throughout the various documentaries, and it is just like, it's like vaguely Masonic as well.
Yeah.
It's like there's been rituals around here.
Definitely. And I mean, there's also been a lot of death around here, too.
Yes, yes. It took a month and one day to unpack everything and get the home situated. On November 15th, right after they finished breaking down the last box, Jamie and Ben plopped down on the couch to relax after the long move. Switching homes is one thing, but moving three young kids on top of it all is kind of a great feat. It was nearly 2 o'clock in the morning as they sank into the cushions, and Jamie flipped mindlessly through the late-night programs. Ben was sleeping on the couch next to her, his busy schedule and the hectic move catching up to him. Finally, everything was going to be so much calmer. Suddenly, Jamie heard the pitter-patter of little stomps going up and down the stairs. Bridger must have woken up, she thought, and she yelled after him to get back into bed. It sounded like the 5-year-old walked past, and she felt his shadow move behind her back toward the stairs. Jamie sternly reminded him that he was 5 years old now and big boys need to sleep in their own beds. But he didn't respond, and the house eventually went still again. Just as she was beginning to doze off, she was awoken by even louder stomps and thuds overhead. This wasn't coming from little scuffling feet. It was straight up pandemonium. Jamie leapt up from her recliner and ran up the stairs, ready to teach her son a lesson. Storming into the room that he shared with Jackson, she found the two boys sleeping peacefully, completely undisturbed. It must have been Tori then, she thought, so she went down the hallway to check. Jamie was dumbfounded when she found her daughter in her bed, fast asleep. Was one of her children playing a prank, or was it possible that someone else was up there? And I don't know, I feel like, you know, with you, both of your children fast asleep in bed, Kendall's asleep too, you're hearing all these noises. How are you feeling?
Oh, I'm thinking there's something going on.
Yeah.
There's either somebody broke in, which I would know that if it was my house, but I would probably be pretty creeped out for sure.
Right.
Be like, okay, you know, process of elimination here.
I've gone to everyone's rooms,
everybody's
fast asleep.
So what am I hearing?
Right.
Am I just hearing voices in my head? Is it something within the walls kind of banging around?
Some squirrels.
Yeah. I mean, in a home this old,
you never know.
There could be some pests.
Some pests
in
but
the walls.
The
but
pandemonious
this is loud.
Pests?
I mean,
yeah.
That'd be insane.
An unshakable sense of dread settled over her as she realized something wasn't right. There was no one in the house, so it couldn't have been an intruder. Maybe she was just exhausted, but everything felt so unmistakably real. She couldn't shake the feeling that someone or something was in the house with them, claiming its territory. Jamie has said that this was the first time she realized that they were not alone in the house. Ben, however, is a natural skeptic, and he would try to reassure her that the weird sounds were due to age, and that was just the cost of living in a historic house. An occasional weird noise and a sudden drop in temperature seemed somewhat normal for a worn and lived-in home, until one night when Ben also heard an inexplicable sound, this time coming from the baby monitor. Jamie's colleague, Desta, offered to watch their kids on weekdays. While Jamie was at work and the two older kids were at school, Ben would get only a few precious hours of sleep between the end of his shift and the beginning of class. The sitter was there simply to watch Jackson at home while Ben rested. One morning, he was woken up to the sound of a baby crying on the monitor. This, of course, was nothing new, so he tried to fall back asleep, knowing that Desta would eventually grab Jackson. But Ben, he got frustrated when the wailing wouldn't end, and it seemed the house itself was crying all around him. He reached to turn off the baby monitor and then stopped, dumbstruck. The monitor wasn't even plugged in.
Which this is one of those, you know, classic traditional baby monitors that, you know, I don't know if it had a battery in it or not, but
right.
A lot of them do, but this is one of those baby monitors that, you know, you just hear in the audio, you know, it uses like radio frequency. And so, yeah, this would creep me the hell out.
This
though,
would freak.
If, like, the baby monitor was clearly off, but I'm still hearing like loud, loud crying. And also knowing that there's somebody there supposed to be getting the child.
Right.
And it shouldn't go on this long.
It shouldn't
be this loud.
And, you know, she's been doing this for some time at this point,
right.
too. Desta knows, like, okay, I got a Jackson.
He's trying to sleep.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I don't want Ben to have to, you know, wake up and handle this.
That would really creep me out.
That would freak
especially
me out.
Especially if I was hearing baby crying and I actually went upstairs and looked, or like I have the video monitor and I was looking at the monitor, I'm hearing crying, but my baby's sleeping. I'd be like, okay,
this
what
is wrong.
The hell?
We're getting frequencies from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Still, the shrieks of a helpless infant continued ringing through the house. Now, completely disturbed, he got out of bed and rushed over to Jackson's room. When he opened the door, the crib was vacant. Ben knew for certain he'd just heard a baby crying, but what if it wasn't Jackson? He checked around the house to find Desta, and when he got downstairs, he found a note explaining that she was running to the store and took Jackson with her.
Dude, the chills that would hit you at that point when you realize there is no baby in the house and you're hearing crying.
And it's like, it's either haunted or something's wrong with you personally. Like, damn, I'm hearing stuff that's not real.
Which, maybe, I mean, when you have a young kid, sometimes you feel like you're, you know, this is a kind of an interesting thing. Kendall and I oftentimes at night will be watching TV and our kids will be asleep. But our daughter, who sleeps in her bedroom now, will be watching TV and then one of us will turn to each other and be like, did you just hear that? Was that Holly? And then we'll like kind of listen, because sometimes you can hear from, you know, across the upstairs floor when she's crying or just making, you know, noises in her room. And often, you know, we'll pull up the monitor and be like, no, she's asleep.
Right.
And not that I think it's anything paranormal, but it's something in the show. Sometimes right, that just right. sounds like Holly's cry or Holly's voice a little bit. And I even had that moment when I was watching the episode for this show, because they played like the baby monitor right. crying sound, and just instincts kicked in, and I like pulled up my phone, was like, who's crying? And nobody was crying. Everybody's fine. But
I mean, I do think that is a serious thing when you're, you know, you're so accustomed to the sound of cries yes. being like, I'm activated. You know, your brain just starts to interpret other sounds as crying. I don't think that's what's happening here, because like clearly it's coming from the monitor, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But still, I do think there is something like some faraway sound. You're so used to hearing crying, meaning I have to go handle a child.
Yeah.
And then you hear it.
No, I think that's important to note, because as a parent with a young kid, you absolutely get programmed.
Right.
You instantly like come out of, no matter how deep of a sleep you're in, you're pulled
activated.
Out immediately, because right. your kid needs you.
Right, right. But still, Ben was beyond puzzled. He knew in his heart what he just heard. He tried to go back to sleep, but was too weirded out to turn off his brain. Desta later told him she'd experienced the same thing before, and they both began to grasp the reality of the situation.
And it wasn't just the adults who were experiencing unsettling occurrences throughout the house. One night, Tori woke up to the sound of Bridger's excessively loud toys. And it can, of course, be hard having a rambunctious little brother, and she marched down the hallway to tell him to keep it down. She stood outside his door, ordering him to knock it off, but it wouldn't stop. She then swung the door open while yelling at him, but paused mid-sentence when she noticed the toys seemed to have complete agency, moving completely on their own. That would be a terrifying sight.
Toy soldier style, Toy
yeah.
Story.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Toy Story going on, haunted edition. Yeah. She called for Bridger, but he didn't answer, so she assumed he was hiding. Before closing the door, she gave him a stern warning to shut up and let her sleep. The next morning, Tori asked him why he was hiding from her last night and playing with his toys so late. And he had no idea what she was talking about, since he had slept with their parents the night before because he was too scared to sleep alone. Makes it that is just terrifying.
That's terrifying. He's like, I'm not, that's not
no,
me.
No, I wasn't even there. There's nobody in my room.
I'm scared myself.
My toys were playing with themselves.
Right.
She decided to keep this bizarre experience to herself, however, since Bridger was already on the edge. He had to sleep with his parents almost every night because his room seemed to desperately want him out. He would lie in the dark staring up at the ceiling, his baby brother's little snores like a lullaby, and every night a storm of voices would emerge, shaking the entire room, and it sounded like there were dozens of people standing over him, frantically talking over each other as if they were desperately needing to explain something. And their words, of course, were indecipherable, just filled with anger, anxiety, and a longing to escape. He never saw anything or anyone, but only heard the booming torrent of bellowing voices. Almost every night, he would jump out of bed and race to his parents' room. Of course, they tried to comfort him, blaming it on the house's age. You know, you're not really hearing voices. But he knew this wasn't the home itself. There was something inside of it.
I just, you know, it calls back, like, you know, memories and thoughts of sleep paralysis, you know, and this, I think, still feels different because he's able to then run
up to
his parents' house. I mean, to his parents' room. But it's still like that, just being a small child and surrounded by voices. Don't even know what they're saying. They're just, you just know what's wrong. Oh, that's awful. That is just awful.
Can't even imagine, honestly.
No.
My worst nightmares are nothing compared to this.
No, and you're a little kid going through this.
Yeah, and the one thing you want as a little kid is to feel safe in your room.
Right.
And when you're scared shitless in your room as a kid, it's over.
It's done. It's done.
Yeah. They suggested that maybe it could have been Tori on her phone or the neighbors just being loud next door. And maybe he was just mistaking a bad dream for reality or just straight up imagining things. But Bridger was insistent that there were several invisible people in his room. He never experienced that kind of anxiety in other places, so Ben and Jamie found it weird that he couldn't sleep on his own. Even after he would crawl into the safety of their bed, they always had a hard time calming him down. And it didn't take long to realize that his room was the center of the activity in the home. The light in the hallway leading to the room always burned out prematurely, aggravating his anxiety, which I'm sure if they left the, you know, hallway light on, there's a little nightlight for you.
Right.
And you hear that thing go off.
Oh my God, no, no, no. I feel like I'm a little kid again hearing the story. Just,
yeah,
totally takes you afraid. Back. Right. And your parents, like, you know, doing their best to calm you down, but ultimately not believing you.
Being in the pitch dark, watching lights go out, and hearing voices in your room, that's going to scare any kid.
Any kid, any adult too.
Any adult, yeah, let's be honest, that happens in my room right now. I'm terrified. Obviously, they were concerned about the electrical situation in the home, so they called in an electrician who told them that he didn't have much of an explanation for why the bulbs kept burning out. Everything should have been working just fine. But Bridger was petrified by the darkness permeating the hallway, so they tried to, you know, come up with a solution for this by installing some touch sensor lights on the walls for him, but the batteries in these brand new lights would die within an hour, constantly thwarting their attempts at giving Bridger some peace of mind. I mean, if you're a kid, just you're like, something is after me. Something does not right. want me to sleep.
And specifically targeting me over my siblings and my parents at this point.
Yeah. Ben and Jamie did their best to shield the kids from the mental anguish. The children were so young, easily spooked, and didn't need any more reasons to be afraid. But still, it was hard to ignore the nonstop voices and hurried footsteps in the middle of the night. On one occasion, Jamie decided to work from home, and she picked up the kids from school after Ben left for the night shift and got everyone settled down for bed. The silence of the home wrapped around her as she prepared for a long night. Logging in on her desktop, she began the monotonous routine of her work. She tried to focus as she typed away on her keyboard, occasionally glancing at the screen to check her work. After a long period of looking up and down, she raised her head and screamed. Someone on the screen was just behind her shoulder, not just watching, but staring with hatred. This scene is straight out of many, many horror movies.
Yes, this is a
nightmare. Reflection of your...
The Black Mirror.
And there's something standing behind you. This figure was black, tall, and almost transparent, transcending all natural laws. Jamie whirled around as the entity dispersed into the room, filling the air with trepidation. She called Ben at work, scared to death, begging him to come home. He practically just started his shift, though, and didn't have much of a choice but to stay there and finish it. After taking some shaky breaths, she calmed down with his help. Ben's soothing nature in moments like these really helped her refocus and really helped her try to rationalize the eerie disturbances. But there was no rationalizing this, though. The presence was now intentionally revealing itself, taunting them and pushing the limits of their psyche. Things just continued to get worse and worse from here, though. They would hear the sound of a ball ricocheting around the stairs late at night, whispering voices in the other room, and sudden intense shifts in energy. Every sound and shadow was full of hostility. It wasn't just a presence. This thing became their enemy. Jamie felt subdued every time she went upstairs, especially near Bridger's room. Corruption was always lurking in the air, tainting every breath. So it's just, you can feel the heaviness as you entered the upstairs. And just knowing that, and knowing that this heaviness lingers around your child's room, I can't imagine the fear
that
would create.
Right, knowing this is for your child too. It's not, it has its own atmosphere. It's so evil.
An invisible hand would push doors open without a sound, and sometimes the family would walk into the kitchen to find all the cabinets and drawers randomly unlatched with their contents exposed. It almost seemed the presence was saying, "You can't control me." One night, Ben and Desta saw the tail end of what looked like a Victorian-style gown dragging up the stairs, conforming to the edges before dissipating like mist. Sometimes they would see a string of smoke as if it was coming off the end of a lit cigarette. Of course, neither of them smoked cigarettes and nothing was ever burning. It was almost comical, and at times they felt they had to laugh at the absurdity of it all. How else do you deal with this presence and the feeling of being preyed upon in your own home without sort of like...
I feel like I would have to joke. I mean, even now, you know, we're joking because it's like facing the potential reality of it is impossible. I mean...
Yeah, it's incomprehensible.
It is. It is.
There's no way. But it's just like... None of this makes sense.
No.
At all. There were a few times when Jamie and Ben actually got to sleep in the bed together, and they'd really try to relish it when given the chance. On multiple occasions, though, they'd be startled awake by the sound of someone angrily pounding on the wall behind their heads. It sounded like someone punching it furiously over and over and over again, and it had evolved from a frightening but passive presence to trying to force them out. Or worse. So it seems like the longer they live here, the more whatever this thing is getting upset.
Right.
And is letting them know in multiple ways, I want you out of here.
I want you out. This is my house. I also think it's like especially cruel considering the fact these are both like very busy individuals, these parents. Yeah.
Young family, with young jobs. And
I mean, Ben is basically, you know, going to work until 7 a.m, coming home. And then sleeping for a few hours before class. And it seems like the presence is like knows this, how precious sleep is to them. And it's like, that's when I'll get them the worst. That's when I'm really going to torment them.
Well, and I think this entity knows that the less sleep they have, the more control it can gain right. over them. And obviously with less sleep, you know, the rational brain stops.
Turns off.
Checks out a bit mm-hmm. and fear sets in.
Right.
And that's exactly what it wants.
So as the weeks went on, everyone became increasingly irritable. They were constantly tormented by strange noises, flickering lights, unexplained voices, and elusive figures. Jamie and Ben were worried about their kids' health due to their lack of sleep, and the busy parents were trying to keep up with their chaotic work lives on top of dealing with the incessant psychological agony. Jamie got in touch with a former teacher at the Historical Society while investigating the property. She learned that at one time, it was a speakeasy, a county jail, and the original stagecoach stop for the area. Along with the people buried right in the backyard, the place had seen all kinds of people from all sorts of backgrounds. Many lives were shared in this house, though some were ended there as well. One day, Jamie unexpectedly ran into someone who potentially had some answers. As she walked in the local Walmart, exhausted, a greeter asked, "Hey, are you Jamie?" It was incredibly strange, but Lamar was a small town, so Jamie just said yes, and the greeter then asked if she lived at the house in Lamar. This was extremely random, but Jamie could barely be surprised given all of the other craziness she'd been experiencing. According to Jamie, the greeter explained that she'd grown up in the house and shared a chilling story passed down through their family's generations. Shortly after the house was built, a young, curious boy tragically fell to his death from the second-story window, now in Bridger and Jackson's room. Ever since, it has been said to be plagued by an evil, violent energy, which has since spread to the rest of the home. I kind of like, I mean, I don't like it because it's scary as hell, but I like this idea of that room being, you know, basically the patient zero for the rest of the house. It starts from there and then slowly builds its way out.
As it often does, you know, and takes over. I mean, think of how many years
right.
this has had to manifest itself
right.
throughout this entire property.
Just growing and building off mm-hmm. of everyone else. And I also wonder, like, this is the one story we know. But again, if it's been the county jail, stage, all these sorts of places, we know there, you know, more likely than not, other people have also met their ends here as well.
Not to mention just the amount of, I think a lot of it comes back to like human emotions and,
right.
you know, the energy generated by, you know, human beings. And so you think about the span of years this thing has been standing there and the amount, you know, amount of range of emotions that have taken place and activities and who knows, right?
It's all just, been collected here.
Right. It's all sort of imprinted itself on this place.
So she said that she knew the house was haunted and recalled experiencing horrifying things while growing up there. Jamie eagerly took down the woman's number before continuing her shopping, glad to have found a friend. Finally, there was someone else who could relate to the absolute madness taking over her life. When she told Ben about it the next morning, he believed her but didn't think a child's ghost could hurt their family. Of course, he was wrong. Jamie was working from home again one night when she heard Bridger's little footfalls as he came down the stairs. She turned around to greet him, but her stomach dropped when she met his gaze. He was caught in a trance-like state, his eyes glossed over, sneering at her with malice. It wasn't physically possible for her innocent son to have these eyes or to possess this indignant energy. It simply wasn't him. Then he broke out in demented, uncontrollable laughter while staring directly into Jamie's soul, his mouth hanging open and his eyes peeled back. According to Jamie, the sound coming from him was not that of a child or even a human, but something from a different world entirely. That cackle, that guttural sound, was one of the scariest things she's ever heard in her life.
I don't even know how you even react to this situation, other than hope they're just sleeping and having a dream.
This will pass over soon. It was horrifying. But he wouldn't stop, and she began shaking him, begging him to snap out of it. His small body was overflowing with darkness that was too big for him to sustain. Then the family dog ran past her up the stairs as if it was chasing something, snarling and foaming at the mouth. He leaped onto Bridger's bed and barked ferociously toward the corner of the room, as if an intruder was lurking in the dark. Finally, the entity abandoned Bridger, returning his soul to him, but there was a deep scar left inside both him and Jamie. After the incident with Bridger, Jamie tried to reach the Walmart greeter, but she'd lost the number. She visited the store, but the employee no longer worked there. And now, the only person who could relate to her situation had disappeared.
That in itself is pretty wild.
I'd be asking myself, like, did this lady even exist?
I think you'd have to. I mean, what are the chances? I mean, it's either that or a very, very weird coincidence.
Right.
That this person happened to tell me this, and then
I
go
lost
back
her
to,
number. She's gone.
Doesn't even yet somehow quit the job before I could go back and talk to. Just very bizarre.
Very bizarre. At this point, the realization sank in that they needed professional help. Not even 3 months after moving in, Jamie contacted the Central Arkansas Society for Paranormal Research, which is known as CASPER, on January 5th, 2003. Her mom had seen the group in the newspaper and told Jamie to reach out. She wrote to CASPER and described more of the horrors she lived with every day and how it was slowly driving her insane. She said the doorbell would go off at random times throughout the day, never letting them have a moment's peace. Sometimes she would wake to the sensation of a small, delicate hand brushing through her hair or feel tiny footsteps scurrying around her bed in the darkness. The house was alive with presences, some small and curious, while others were heavy and gut-wrenching, all impossible to ignore. Twice a week, Jamie would go to put on her shoes in the morning and find that several dimes were stuffed inside them or sometimes crammed inside her bed. Batteries for everything drained in minutes, almost suggesting that the house was incompatible with life. She had hope because CASPER was renowned throughout the state for investigating haunted homes and assisting families dealing with poltergeist activity. Karen Schillings, the founder, was more than happy to jump on board and find a way to get answers for the Shea family.
Which, in many stories we've covered, the first step is often not to reach out to paranormal investigators. It's often to reach out to some type of religious entity, oftentimes a priest. And
let me get an exorcist going on.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let's go straight to that. So I do find it a really smart move to reach out to paranormal investigators, somebody who's maybe had experience with this type of activity they're enduring, and get their opinion on it. And so that's exactly what they did. So Karen Shillings founded the nonprofit Ghost Hunting Organization in 1999, and it gained popularity among several other paranormal groups in Arkansas as interest in ghost hunting increased since the early 2000s. The organization didn't just seek to provide emotional and spiritual support, but also to conduct thorough investigations of haunted locations using a variety of technical equipment. And here's where the magic of paranormal investigation happens. Casper uses all the standard ghost hunting equipment, including, you know, an EMF reader to detect energy levels, frequencies, which obviously is a key tool when looking for, you know, electromagnetic fields and interactions. Sometimes you can find something that's impacting the fields, appliances, power lines, something hidden within the walls. But the group relies on infrared cameras to document what happens after dark, setting them up to watch for hours at a time. They'd also leave audio recorders running overnight as well, hoping to catch these unexplained voices or sounds that might slip through in the quiet. Every detail is monitored, searching for something that can't be explained away. And one of the most interesting tools they have is a thermal scanner, which detects rapid temperature changes, or a thermal thermometer. And according to the group, a change of 10 degrees can indicate an ethereal presence. Valerie Scatterfield, who's the regional director of Casper, told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette about a phenomenon they call the creep factor. And this happens when the hair on the back of your neck stands up upon entering a haunted location, and most people can feel it. Sometimes all it takes is a chill down your spine to know you're not alone. Smaller groups make it easier to detect spirits with less noise and fewer distractions, whereas large crowds can scatter the energy, making it harder to sense the spirits on the prowl. Which I think that's a really good thing to note, because oftentimes you go to a haunted location and you don't experience anything, you don't feel right. anything. And oftentimes, like a hotel, for example, the Stanley Hotel, and thinking back to going to the Stanley Hotel to experience paranormal, there are a lot of people there.
Right.
And so maybe the energy is not as strong because of all of the people walking around and staying in the hotel that you just, so I gotta be amazing to go there and stay there alone.
Solo style. I mean, you have to do it like Stephen King mode, where you're the only one in the hotel.
Yes.
You know?
That, and I'm sure, you know, the experience would be far different. When it came to the Lamar haunting, Karen was more sensitive to Bridger's situation because she became susceptible to the paranormal at a young age. And she believes that children connect more easily with the spirit world than adults do, since they're less weighed down by fear or skepticism. They're more open. That's why Bridger's behavior made sense to her. He was more open and maybe more vulnerable to whatever haunted their house. But Casper was eager to help when Jamie contacted them, but they unfortunately had to put their investigation on hold when a horrible accident made everything significantly worse.
And this is where things kind of take a turn from the paranormal into, you know, real world horrors and real world tragedies.
And just the effects that the paranormal can have on life outside of the home. And just the impact it has on the individual.
One morning, Jamie was loading Jackson into the car and getting ready to pick up Bridger and Tori from school. Supposedly, before leaving, she noticed a figure staring down at her from the upstairs window, as if it was glad to see her leaving. Being fairly used to these shadows and the dread they produce, she just got into the car and drove off. After securing the two older kids, Jamie headed back, planning their regular evening routine. On the way home, they entered a construction area, which was no big deal at first.
Out of nowhere, a barrel broke loose and shot across the road right in front of them. Instinct took over, and Jamie jerked the wheel, trying to avoid the obstacle. The car skidded, then flipped, over and over again, until finally slamming into a ditch. Everything was a blur at first, and Jamie could barely comprehend what was happening. As she slowly opened her eyes, she realized they were hanging upside down. Suddenly, it hit that all of her children were in that car. Whipping her head back, she saw the boys suspended by their seatbelts, miraculously unharmed. Then she realized that Tori wasn't in her seat. She wasn't even in the car. Jamie was helpless, stuck in place, and only just beginning to fully understand what had happened. A woman's scream pierced the air as she frantically begged for help. There was someone pinned under the car. It was Tori. Trapped beneath the van, she could barely breathe, with thousands of pounds holding her down and cold mud pressing into her mouth and nose. At just 10 years old, she was far too small to withstand the crushing weight. Fortunately, it had been raining nonstop the past few days, so Tori was able to essentially sink into the dirt while trapped underneath instead of being crushed to death. Every second stretched into terror as she fought to stay conscious, praying someone would reach her in time. They found her face down, her neck and back broken, and bones splintered in several places. She survived, but just barely, spending 10 days in the ICU. Each day was a fight for life and holding on to sensations in her legs. Jamie and Ben were shattered when the doctors couldn't say if she would ever walk again.
I think it's, you know, it's also somewhat of a miracle.
Yeah.
This soft ground. I mean, this is now the second case, the other one being a mile higher, where just the fact that the ground itself was soft saved someone's life.
I would call that a miracle.
Absolutely.
There was something looking out for her that day.
Yeah. So with Tori confined to a wheelchair and needing constant care, Jamie postponed the Casper visit, afraid of bringing more stress to her family. She later said she didn't believe the haunting had anything to do with the crash, but maybe the added stress of the paranormal activity made her driving more erratic. For a brief time after the crash, possibly because they were more distracted, there was little paranormal activity to report on. It didn't take long, though, for everything to return to its grim state. On one of those rare nights that Jamie and Ben were sleeping together, she kept feeling her hair being flipped over her face. And the hair stuff especially gets me. I mean, whether before we're talking about like the hand going through her hair as if it was like brushing her. That's what that really gets me.
Yeah. Nothing like a phantom brushing your hair for you.
Twirling my shit.
Yeah.
Like, no, man. That's
To feel like a physical sensation, I think, is a whole other level of fear unlocked.
Absolutely.
Versus just visually or hearing something auditory, like the physical touch is where things just cross a line.
And for some reason, you know, hair, I feel like, just because it feels strange, you know, you don't feel all your hair. I can't feel when I touch just one strand. I feel the tip. But so then just to have that added, like, oh, I can't
sensational.
Even, yeah, yeah, that's, and look, she was sleeping on her side and asked Ben to stop, thinking he was just teasing her, but quickly realized he was passed out. Over and over, strands of hair were flicked up before landing over her eyes and mouth. According to the paranormal show A Haunting, the furniture in their room began to shake in a frenzy, the lights flashing like strobes. The kids screamed in terror, and the family gathered together and fled the home for the night. After that, they asked the sitter to take the kids so they could reach out to Casper again.
And Casper sent psychic Angela Lowe, her husband, Alan Lowe, and their daughter, Violet, who identified as a medium. When the three of them arrived to the house, Violet claimed she could have two-way conversations with some of the spirits, and the moment that she walked in, a heavy, depressing energy settled over her. Angela agreed, instantly feeling the same oppressive shift. The further they moved through the house, the stronger the unsettling energy became. Inside Bridger's room, they claimed to be surrounded by multiple spirits, which they described as a sea of people, and heard angry voices just as the family did. Violet described the spirits as miserable, radiating hatred and disdain. She said these entities didn't even look human, with their shapes and faces so twisted and unnatural that just getting a glimpse of them sent chills down her spine. The investigators concluded that the home was inhabited by multiple, if not dozens, of malevolent spirits. That's not a good diagnosis.
Yeah. No, when the spirits outnumber the members of your family,
maybe it's best to be leave them alone.
Yeah,
know?
Just let's. This is your house, guys.
Which sucks because they just got this house. They love it.
Right.
Besides the activity. But they believed that the occult ceremony that had been performed in Bridger's room was to blame, actually, proposing the idea that a dark portal was opened and allowed these spirits to come through. They could have opened a tunnel to the other side, and it just let whatever energies were waiting on the other side come into the physical realm. So that's interesting that they went back to that of right. Like, no, we believe that it wasn't just teenagers playing around, or maybe they were playing around, but they actually opened up something. Or there's practicing cultists who have lots of experience doing this.
Well, and I bet they're pissed also if we're going down this cult route. They're probably pissed that now there's a family up in their ritual space.
Yes, exactly. And that was their intention the entire time, was we need to make sure that whoever comes in here or buys this house leaves it immediately.
Right. Karen also reportedly had an experience with the entity during the investigation and described feeling a terrible presence in the house on her very first visit. She was lying on the couch one night waiting for an encounter when an abysmal murmur penetrated her ears. She felt paralyzed and held down by something immensely heavy and could only dart her eyes around looking for the culprit. Based on what she'd heard and seen, she knew the house needed to be cleansed. And it almost sounds like she may have had an episode of sleep paralysis.
Right.
Whether that was brought on by her, you know, or something else is pretty insane. But then the paranormal group brought out a Ouija board.
Come on, guys.
And you ask anybody, they'll tell you, unless you know explicitly how to use one of these things and use it correctly, you oftentimes make things worse.
It was funny, the comments on the YouTube videos about it were like, oh, they brought the Ouija board? Kick them out of your house.
Yeah. Who are these people? So they bring out the Ouija board to attempt to contact these spirits. Ben was highly skeptical at first, but willing to do anything to help his family be happy and whole again. Which, yeah, I think most of us hearing this would be like, uh-oh, nothing ever good comes from right. Ouija board sessions. Very rare that a talking board actually just gives you some innocent answers. But oftentimes, it does the exact opposite of that. Right.
Well, and, you know, to Jamie and Ben's credit, they probably, you know, a Ouija board in popular culture is a toy, you know.
Which is wild in itself.
I know.
That this is sold as a toy.
We sold them at the board game shop. I'd be like, all right, guys.
But, the Hasbro one?
Uh-huh, the Hasbro one. It's a real piece of shit. But,
yeah.
But I understand why they would be like, all right, yeah, whatever you guys think, you know. Ouija board, sure, why not? This is their first brush with this sort of thing.
And maybe their thought was, if, you know, we're having no luck these other ways.
Because right.
It brought a medium in there, and a medium should be able to communicate with these entities in some way. I mean, most of the times there's, you know, a way to do it. But to get the Ouija board out, maybe there was more thought behind it than we know. But what they did was just ask it, what's its name?
Right.
Who are you? What are you? And on the board, it spelled out S-E-T-H, Seth. And when it's not known who or what Seth is or where Seth is from. But to give you a little bit of history on the name Seth, it's a biblical name given to the third son of Adam and Eve after their son Cain murdered his brother Abel. And in the Egyptian tradition, the god Seth is responsible for chaos, storms, and destruction, which sounds eerily similar to the presence in this home. The investigators then asked what time period Seth was from, thinking it could have been a Confederate soldier, perhaps, that lived on the property at some point. And his answer made their hearts sink. N-E-V-E-R. Never. So not a humanly presence whatsoever, it seems, because Seth claimed to have never lived or died, according to the Ouija board. That could have meant many different things, but perhaps the most frightening answer was the fact that he was most likely demonic in nature, an everlasting spirit, maybe even emanating from the very depths of hell, for all they know.
I mean, or just at the very least existing outside of time, which I don't want that.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like the family didn't have a lot of like strong religious
right.
ideology sort of going into this. And so the way that I would look at it is, just because this is a negative entity, I don't think necessarily means it. And I get the biblical connection with the name. So I get that's the direction they went with it, that this is some sort of spawn of Satan of
right.
some sort. But it also could just be some type of lower dimensional entity, some other being from another, you know, layer of reality that is even masking itself as perhaps, you know, a biblical demon to allow us humans to sort of comprehend it.
Right, and figure out what it is.
Figure out, exactly. And so who knows, though? I mean, this thing could be a bunch of different things. But they asked Seth if anyone had ever seen him. And a few moments later, the planchette, which we all know what that is, slowly pointed to the camera. And right as that happened, Alan saw a shadow appear on the monitor. The group then witnessed a mist-like head form near the ceiling, with shoulders appearing beneath it. It was almost human-like, but not enough to conjure any semblance of familiarity. But could this have been Seth, perhaps proving his physical abilities? That's pretty chilling to think about that. At that moment, then something appeared.
Right.
And if it was Seth, maybe, or was it something else? Who knows? But it lingered only for a minute before fading away, seemingly dissolving into thin air. Apparently, it appeared and then disappeared numerous times throughout the reading, and they claim to have caught it on tape, although none of us have ever seen the footage. But the house also got extremely cold that night, way colder than it usually did. The discomfort was palpable, as the spirits made it known that everything there was unwelcome. Jamie also claimed that during the encounter, that she felt the presence suffocating her, pushing her whole body into the creaky floorboards, like this crushing weight coming down upon you. But things then got scarier than they had ever been at that point, as they communicated with Seth and perhaps multiple other spirits. Jamie was sick with worry that they may have released something even darker into the home during this paranormal interview. What's that? Smart thinking, because absolutely,
yeah,
that is what happened.
You made it worse on accident.
The Casper team said Seth and the other spirits in the house were some of the most intense presences they had ever encountered. Angela and Violet attempted to cleanse the space with sage, hoping to drive out whatever was haunting the family, and I think at this point, sage is not going to cut it.
No.
Casper doesn't publish paranormal findings or private investigations out of respect for the people affected, so it was very difficult to even find details around what they exactly did and sort of their version of the story, which is kind of interesting to me, which I get, protect the privacy of
right.
the family, but it is a little weird to me that you wouldn't want to release findings on this if this is what your right. experience is.
I also find it interesting that they're a non-profit ghost hunting organization just in general.
Yeah, that is interesting.
They're just doing it for charity, really.
Hey, you know what? All the power to them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we need more non-profit paranormal investigators
out yeah,
there.
At least one more.
Yeah, one more. But it's unknown whether this Casper group is still together. It's unclear whether the Casper organization or group is still together, given that this was over 20 years ago. And they may have also changed their name, it sounds like, to the Coalition of Advancing Scientific Paranormal Research, which is, this is according to Karen's YouTube channel. They were a popular group at the time, so it makes sense why Jamie reached out to them. But Jamie felt as though nothing had improved after the attempts to expel the spirit from the Casper group. And the family finally hit their wits' end and called it quits.
So at some point after making contact through the Ouija board, the Shea family decided to leave and rent the house out. The toll on their mental and physical health was too much to bear, and they've never felt at home within those walls that seemed to close in on them. They essentially left as soon as they could, and Jamie began publishing articles online about her family's experience. That's when New Dominion Pictures contacted Jamie to discuss using their story for a televised documentary. Jamie and Ben shared their story on an episode of A Haunting, a Discovery Channel paranormal series. In January 2007, they spent several days recounting as much as they could about their experiences in the house. The episode aired on September 21st, 2007, nearly 5 years after they'd first moved in. I don't know if you remember, but, you know, when I was a little kid, I loved watching, like, Discovery Channel paranormal stuff. Truth or Scare on Discovery Kids was my jam. But A Haunting was genuinely too scary for me.
Yeah, they really drum up the scare factor in it, for sure.
They make, and I think it's also because, like, the way they have the characters interact with each other to make it seem, like, almost mundane and realistic, and it's shot in that documentary style. That then when shit does kick off, no matter how fake it
looks, hits hard.
It's like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, they definitely took like the horror movie sort of
Absolutely.
Style to it, you know, with the sound effects and the reenactments and stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So their episode was titled Where Evil Lurks, and it took many liberties when telling their story, according to Jamie. While much of it is true, there are some inconsistencies or straight up fabrications. The series also uses aliases, which can be confusing compared to independent interviews with Jamie. She claimed to be disappointed when the episode came out because she felt like the real story was more interesting. It did, however, do a good job of capturing the horror the family felt during that time.
Which I'm like, yeah, their real story
is terrifying.
It's terrifying.
It doesn't
enough.
Need anything else.
You don't need the demon to be wielding a knife or whatever.
Yeah,
know?
Or somehow involved with the car accident right. and stuff like that. I mean, that's taking a bit far.
That's too far, especially when like it seriously.
Actually, yeah, exactly. To try to attribute that to paranormal activities, a little is a bit much. Like, no, how about just sleep? They are not sleeping.
They're not sleeping because there are ghosts. You know. Shortly after the episode was released, a journalist visited Jamie at the house for an interview for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. While visiting the kitchen, the journalist casually looked around and realized that all the cabinet doors had silently inched open. Needless to say, they were beyond creeped out. Shannon Sturgis, a photographer who had joined them, witnessed a shadow hovering near one of the cabinets. She said it looked different than a regular shadow, and that it was three-dimensional, sort of floating below the ceiling, just like the presence they saw during the Ouija reading. When the photographer brought it up, Jamie just nodded and said shadows like that were nothing new. By then, she was almost numb to the foul nature of the home. When Ben and Jamie began attempting to rent out the house, they weren't having any luck, which, you know, honestly makes sense.
Yeah, imagine being the renter and be like, why are you guys renting it out?
You know, it's just creaks. It creaks sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that must have been tough to even convince somebody to come rent it.
You have to
be like, well, you guys just bought, you only lived here for, like, that's pretty sketchy,
that's
right?
Pretty
if
sketchy.
You're a renter and you went to a house, you're like, wait, you guys just bought this?
And you're moving with your three kids into an apartment instead of this big ass house? Three separate families all quickly escaped after experiencing what life is like behind those old walls. The last family moved out on May 15th, 2007, and the Shea family tried to move back in after a couple of months in September 2007, even though they were never able to fully settle in. One night after returning, they were sitting around the kitchen table, playing cards and listening to a burnt CD. Suddenly, it skipped forward to track 99, where it sang out in a muffled voice, "You need to help. You need to help. You need to help." Jamie decided that that was the last straw and immediately put the cards down and packed the family up. She later looked through the lyrics of each song on the CD and found nothing containing that phrase. The persecution was never ending, and no matter what, the spirits made sure to make their intentions known. It felt as though they were stuck with the house, like an incurable disease. Nobody wanted it, and it seemed to cling to the Shea family, needing someone to torment. Jamie would often write about their experience, needing the world to hear their unique and life-changing experience. In one of her articles, Jamie joked that, "When the neighbor's pet gerbil ends up fully baked in our microwave, my favorite vase gets smashed by a Nerf football, or my husband's cell phone is found floating in the bathwater, instead of blaming each other, her kids would blame the ghosts."
Because that's a very convenient excuse.
That's a very convenient.
And a valid one.
Right? Yeah. If I was a kid, yeah, anytime.
Anytime something bad happened, even if I did it, I'd be like, wasn't
Seth,
me?
Bro. Seth got to
Seth's
it.
Seth put the gerbil in the microwave. Good God.
Almost a year after she posted that article, they finally sold the home on December 22nd, 2008, 6 years after the purchase.
As of 2025, Jamie has found a new outlet for her fascination with the unknown, co-hosting her own podcast, The Unexplained Archives, with her friend Jennifer Gentner. In one episode, she sits down with Austin Kraska, who created Documentary 1 that we watched about the Shea family haunting for his YouTube channel, The Ghost Files. Very good, by the way. Jamie frequently weaves her own stories of life in a haunted house into the show, offering listeners a glimpse into the unsettling reality she once called home. The Lamar House is up for sale again, listed at $118,000 on various real estate websites, and you can see on Zillow Records that it was sold by Ben and Jamie in 2008. Long after the family abandoned the house on the hill, the land remains quiet on the surface. The old colonial home stands empty and its windows staring blankly out across desolate fields. Locals tell stories about the house from hell, everyone avoiding it like the plague. And to this day, no one stays long. Although Ben and Jamie were luckily able to sell it, subsequent owners have realized the grave mistake of their purchase. The home endures a constant cycle of new families moving in, only to run for their lives shortly after. and it makes you wonder how long this will stay standing before someone decides to come along and destroy it. Which, does destroying it actually release you know, whatever presence, entity, energy that's trapped in this place permanently? Or is it like Hill House?
Right.
Where the house refuses to be destroyed.
It's gonna destroy the tractor. It's gonna destroy the bulldozer.
Exactly. It's gonna put the fire out if someone tries to set fire to it. That's always an interesting thing to it. I kind of like leave it up.
Leave it. I also think just from the historical standpoint, like
maybe just make it a landmark or something.
Yeah, make it a museum. I don't know. We in Golden, the Astor House is supposedly super haunted as well, and I could believe it. Hella people died there, but. You know, there was a time where it sat abandoned for decades, and now it's just a wonderful museum. And I think
maybe it's time.
Yeah, we should treasure these old buildings.
No one lived there. Just make it or turn it into an attraction.
Right.
You know, you could make it a paranormal destination, as many people are doing these days, and preserve it that way, or just make it, you know, like you said, a museum. I think it should be preserved at the end of the day, I think, and studied more.
Right.
Like, I think it'd be interesting to get some more, you know, different types of people in there. And it was interesting to me that they, you know, you had Casper go in, you know, doing some, you know, Native American rituals, you know, some sage cleansing, but not once did a priest or a religious sort of individual come in and give their opinion on it, especially since there was a demon,
right?
Supposedly in there, that you'd think it'd be time to call the priest up and get the exorcism going.
You'd think. I feel like this is the one time where it's not even requested. They don't even think like, all right, we got to get the priest up in here. What I also like about this one is the variety of hauntings, including the ones that always get to me is when it's in the camera monitor or when it's on the computer screen, like just in the reflection. It makes me think of like the. I bet there's a better term for this, but like in a lot of Japanese horror movies, there's this digital ghost.
Yeah.
Where it's like the spirit is coming from the machine itself. And I don't think that's the case here. This seems a lot older than that. But I like how many fold this entity is able to appear and make itself known.
Yeah. And I think there's multiple sources of the paranormal entities here. I think there's a combination of just the sheer history and dark events that have taken place on this land and perhaps in this house going on. And then you also have sort of this occult ritual being performed in the house, supposedly, that adds this whole other angle to it that's maybe responsible for Seth arriving on the scene. But it seems like this, I mean, you talk about a colonial home, you know, 100 plus years of history. I think it was already haunted before. Right. So I think there's multiple sources here, and some of it is perhaps just sort of this innocent residual energy left over from the past. But then you have this dark figure that is looming within that has made itself home in their home. And somebody needs to go deal with that.
Yeah, let's deal.
Someone needs to deal with Seth.
Yeah, or just let him be.
Or just let him be and pay him a visit every now and then.
Yeah, that's how I would like to do it. But I don't know. I think it's also... You know, it's I feel like with haunted houses in particular, you know, we have the English Gothic tradition, right?
Right.
Where it's these like way older than even this house is. And that's where the ghosts and spirits live in all these different homes. Whereas like in the American Gothic tradition, it's more of the landscape is what's evil. So what's interesting with this one is that it's both the home itself that becomes this phantasmagoria, and the landscape with the cemetery behind it. It's like both.
It's a double whammy, man.
Right. It's American and English Gothic.
That's why it needs to be preserved
and
studied. I mean, I would be so interested to go out there. I think all three of us would go out there and just want to see what's going on.
I want to do some rubbings of the cemetery. That looks awesome.
At the very least.
Right.
Figure out who's buried there.
Right.
And what, you know, what all went down. And it'd be very interesting to see some more perspectives on it. Just the one, if I could ask Jamie anything, I'd be like, why did you just stop after Casper came in?
Right.
Did you ever think about, and maybe she did, but did you ever think about reaching out to, you know, maybe a more well-known paranormal investigator, or have a member of the clergy go out there and give their opinion on it? And Because that's what would have been interesting is, could we have somebody go out and confirm the presence of Seth?
Right.
You know, someone from the clergy come out and then, and I mean, anybody from a religious standpoint is probably going to go into this home and be like, yes, it's infested with demons.
There's some shit going on here.
There is demonic activity here. Everything here, nothing is, you know, everything is evil. And we need to perform an exorcism
right.
immediately. So I'd ask her, how come I'm surprised Casper wasn't like, the next step would be to have somebody come perform an exorcism right. in the home and try that and just see what happens, right? Because as we've seen in so many different haunting stories, that's sort of the go-to is get a priest out there and
this
perform
is what
an exorcism.
Will solve it.
And it often does. Right. And so before abandoning the home, I wonder if that thought ever crossed her mind, or maybe they're just so over at that point that it was just like, we just need to get out
Let's
of here.
Let's get, yeah.
Because even if you do rid the house of this entity or the activity, your kids are forever like traumatized
right.
From their experience. I don't know how as a kid you ever get over that. I mean, yeah, look at the Haunting of Hill House. I mean, those kids were fucked up till the end.
For the rest of their lives.
Right,
you
from
know, it's
just
trauma.
Those. So it's like, of course, it's a fictional example, but it's very much, you know, a lot of similarities here with, and obviously see where that show gets so much inspiration from
right.
real hauntings. I don't know. I think this is one of the more credible stories. I tend to believe Jamie's experience through and through. You have multiple people coming in, confirming the activity, experiencing it firsthand. I think it is interesting. You know, we don't have the elements of the authorities being called.
Right.
She didn't call the police. So it doesn't seem like there's any sort of official records that exist to confirm any of it, which will leave many skeptics, a little disappointed, right? You're like, well, was there some ulterior motive here? But why on earth would she make this up to terrorize her kids? Or, you know, something
for a couple
like
of
that.
Blog posts.
Yeah, for a blog post and a podcast and a episode on Discovery. Like, no, there's no monetary real gain right. from making all this up.
And I would be interested to see if the children will say anything, you know, maybe show up on the podcast, maybe. Or maybe they're just like, nope, this is my mom's thing. I don't
right.
want to
they
talk
just want to forget it.
Right.
Never relive it again. Danny, how do you feel about it? Are you, if you're skeptical about it, what would be your sort of like logical explanation?
I mean, I'm always skeptical about every single paranormal case we do. But one thing I do find about this case that does lead me, that gives it more credibility in my eyes, is that the family isn't religious. Because I feel like in a lot of cases, when the family is heavily religious, they have a predisposition to believe in paranormal entities and things like that. So the fact that they didn't have this, it gives it more credibility in my eyes, even if they didn't have, you know, law enforcement come in and any of those other people. It's just that fact alone kind of gives it more credibility. As far as a explanation to this story, I don't really have one. There's just a lot of crazy things in there. The children aren't really old enough to really be getting into trouble like this. They wouldn't. I can't see children like, this young doing this as a prank or
yeah,
anything like
right.
that.
Yeah, totally. And, I would be like, how do you even pull that off?
Exactly. And I mean, especially after the car accident and everything too, it's very obvious that no matter what was happening with the family, whether it be paranormal or personal that we don't know, it was having a very negative effect on their lives, affecting their sleep, and then compounded with that tragic accident. I can imagine them just wanting to get out of this house, even if it was cleansed by a priest or anything, just the memories in that house and the feeling of just pain that this house brought on, they would want to escape it. Right. So I still remain skeptical about the case, but I very much believe the pain the family went through. And
yeah,
I'm very happy that they're out of it now.
Yeah,
totally. I think the one other question that came to mind too is I would ask Ben and Jamie if they had the home inspected before purchasing it.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have it inspected inside and out? Because obviously the one big question mark from a logical rationale is there something in the home? Is there a gas leaking? Is there some wiring situation going on? Like, is there some rational explanation to that could create the unsafe atmosphere for, you know, even if it's a slow leak of something, or is there something in the soil? I mean, there's lots of other sort of things that could possibly explain maybe hallucinations or auditory noises that could just be explained to the house being so old,
right?
That may have been going on behind the walls or something like that. Or, I mean, some of it could even be, as we kind of alluded to, pests within the walls, you know, you know, some of the noises and banging behind them while they're sleeping. I mean, HVAC can make banging sounds in your walls, and I have a newer house and it's still
banging.
And I'm like, I know what it is now, but at first I was like, oh, duh.
I'm fucking haunted.
Followed me home finally.
I mean, when I was a kid, I had squirrels that lived in my roof, and they would make chitter chatter noises and pounding noises all through the night. And
could that possibly been going on in Bridger's room?
Yeah.
And I think that's where having a complete paranormal investigation and just investigation in general is super important with these cases. And sadly, a lot of times we don't see that. It's very one-sided. That's what I would do is, if I were to buy this house, I'd do a full-blown inspection. I'd dig a hole.
Room by room.
Yes, I'd go in the basement and dig a hole 20 feet down or wherever on the property and see, let's take some soil samples too. Let's see what the geological makeup is underneath it, because there could be something affecting, you know, electromagnetic energy underneath it that's like some sort of natural anomaly. And then cut some holes in those walls and start looking in and see what's going on behind the walls that you can't see. And I mean, you can look at some of the pictures on the Zillow listing. I mean, this is old. It's very much barely hanging on, it looks like. Well, so.
And I bet, you know, Jamie and Ben included, no one really stays long enough to fix it up.
Right.
You know, because it's fucked up.
Get in there, like, gotta get out.
Yeah.
But who knows? At the end of the day, that's the beauty and terrifying part of the paranormal is just, it's unexplained.
Right.
It's unexplained activity. We don't know exactly what it is. It could be interpreted a lot of different ways depending on the knowledge that you have, your prior experiences. And at the end of the day, I think this is an old location with a dark history. And whenever you couple those together in these spots, it's, you know, you're bound to have some very strange things happen. But let us know your thoughts. I want to know, what do you think about this home? Do you think this is a true paranormal story, or do you think there are some logical explanations that could explain some of these things, as we talked about? Also, if you have a paranormal story or location or family haunting you want to see next, drop that in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, and we'll get right on it, because, you know, we love a good paranormal story here and there. It's a different darkness.
It's a different darkness. And it's I don't know, I don't want to say more fun, because obviously it was horrible for Jamie and Ben.
Right.
But it is for us, at least, to discuss these sorts of things. It opens the mind.
Totally. But that's going to be it for us today. Thank you for being here with us. If you enjoy the Lights Out podcast, make sure you're subscribed. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, there's a subscribe or follow button. That's a great, easy, free way to support the show. We also have some new Lights Out merchandise. We have some new designs for summer. That's over at mileharmerch.com. Really cool stuff. Some embroidered tees. We kind of went this like Miami Vice sort of feel and look to it. And all proceeds from that go to support the Higher Hope Foundation, which supports victims and their families of violent crime and organizations that support them as well. So it goes to a great cause. Get some merch. We love you guys. We'll see you next week. Till then, lights out, everybody.